Hi, everyone, and welcome to Education for Sustainable Democracy, the podcast about how educational experiences can strengthen democratic participation and environmental sustainability. My name's Brett Levy, and I'm a researcher of civic and environmental education and an associate professor of education at the University at Albany, State University of New York. This month marks 3 years since this show began. So happy anniversary, and thanks for listening. I appreciate your ongoing interest in these issues and all the support you've given me through your comments, emails, sharing and posting episodes, and everything else. And here's some good news. The show was just included on FeedSpot's list of the top 100 classroom podcasts. So thanks again for all your support, and please keep spreading the word. And now for the third anniversary episode, I'm very excited to have Walter Parker, Professor Emeritus at the University of Washington, Seattle. Walter Parker is one of the most influential social studies education scholars of our time, and he has a new book out entitled Education for Liberal Democracy, Using Classroom Discussion to Build Knowledge and Voice, which argues that education can and must address a twofold crisis in our democracy, a legitimacy crisis and an epistemic crisis. Please stay tuned to hear all the wisdom that Walter has to share. And if you're new to this show, welcome, and please be sure to subscribe. To find other episodes and more information about the show, you can visit esdpodcast.org. Also, in the show notes, you can find links to my open access articles, to the show's Facebook page and YouTube channel, and to resources related to this show's topic. Thank you so much for your support. Now, here's my conversation with Walter Parker. Walter, it's an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Great to be here, Brett.
So I have a lot of questions for you about your new book, but I'll start with this one. You've had a long and illustrious career, and we were just talking about how you've enjoyed the beginning of your retirement, and it sounds really wonderful. What prompted you to write this new book after you retired from your role as a professor at the University of Washington?
Well, I knew that I would retire from teaching at UW, but that I would continue with my scholarship, which I love. And to me, it became only more important shortly after my retirement when we had the insurrection and it became very clear that the country was in a serious political crisis. And I wanted to work on that crisis and do so from the bailiwick that I know best, which is civic education, which I've been working in for 4 decades or so now. So I wanted to stick with the professional domain that I knew best and see what I could do from there to affect civic education across the country and in my own state, working with a coalition here of various organizations from the League of Women Voters to the judges organizations, the Superior Court judges, the municipal judges, and various attorney groups such as the Board of Trial Attorneys. We've managed to get laws passed that support civic education in the state. So I have not stopped working on civic education in retirement. And this book is was a labor of love through those 3 years. It's a collection. Several of the chapters are new. Most of the chapters have been previously published. So I gathered this collection together under the theme of Education for Liberal Democracy.
Mm-hmm. And for the audience, that's the title of the book. And I recommend that all of you get it. It's a really great book. And before I get into it, actually, you mentioned that you've worked on legislation. Could you talk a bit about the civic education policies that you've been working on?
Yes. Early on, we passed a law that requires K-12 schools and then colleges of education to teach about Indigenous peoples of Washington. We have 29 federally recognized tribes. And so that developed into a large program called Since Time Immemorial, which your listeners can Google and get access to those curriculum materials. So that was important because that brought teaching about tribal sovereignty into the heart of the social studies curriculum in the state of Washington. And related law required colleges of teacher education to educate new teachers in tribal sovereignty and what that meant. And so many districts throughout the state now collaborate with local tribes to teach about indigenous culture and this political concept of tribal sovereignty. Mm-hmm. The next law we worked on was one that requires the high school government course for graduation. Mm. So I'm excited about that. Most students take the high school government course in their senior year when they're turning 18. So it becomes a place to get them registered to vote. And most importantly, get them knowledgeable about government and politics. There's a lot to know there. Mm-hmm. And as we know, the adult population in the United States is quite ignorant about how the government works, how politics works. Mm-hmm. So the next legislation we're working on is getting the teachers of that course supported. So there's mm-hmm. good professional development at a nearby university, wherever they are in the state. Mm-hmm. And that's been a long slog, but I'm hopeful mm-hmm. that we'll get there.
Well, that's great. That's great. Keep me updated on that. And thanks for your work on all of that.
Yeah, it's great.
So I'm wondering if you could summarize the core argument of your book, Walter.
The core argument is that civic education needs to clarify its aim. And I'm referring to civic education in K-12 schools. And I argue that the proper aim of civic education in schools is to shore up liberal democracy. And the reason why that is important and needed now is the political crisis in which our political culture is now steeped and sinking. And we're at a very dangerous period in our democracy, nothing like it since the Civil War, except possibly the Great Depression. That's the political crisis that we face in our political culture, but it involves a knowledge crisis as well. I separate out the two crises and call one a legitimacy crisis and the other an epistemic crisis. So the legitimacy crisis is, of course, that many people don't believe the government is legitimate, hopelessly rigged, hopelessly racist. The legitimacy crisis has been going on a long time. It intensified with the murder of Floyd in Minneapolis, but it's been going on at least since the Vietnam War, the Watergate crisis, the agonies of Afghanistan and Iraq. The epistemic crisis is a crisis in knowledge, and I'm referring specifically to the fact that we no longer have a shared reality because we no longer have shared criteria for distinguishing fact and fiction. So this is a serious contextual issue in which civic education can make an important contribution. So what I'm trying to do in the book is argue that civic education ought to zero in on shoring up liberal democracy now that it's threatened in so many ways. And I propose classroom discussion and a kind of stepped up attention to which knowledge is of most worth as a way of dealing with that crisis in a doable way in the schools.
So could you talk a bit about how classroom discussions could address the epistemic crisis and the legitimacy crisis? What is the content or the skills or the values that you think mm-hmm. these highly interactive experiences in classrooms could do to address those challenges?
Right. One way to put it is to say that two objectives are to develop students' knowledge of liberal democracy, how government and politics work in a liberal democracy, how you go about improving a liberal democracy, how you close all sorts of opportunity gaps and equity gaps. But in addition to deepening students' knowledge about liberal democracy, a second objective would be to cultivate their voices, by which I mean their ability to make an uncoerced decision. So that's also the definition of political autonomy, the ability to make uncoerced decisions. And to put it in the vernacular, it's the ability to think for yourself. So we have quite a, in terms of exercising our voice, we have quite a challenge because, of course, we need to think with others in a liberal democracy. You have to bridge differences with dialogue in a liberal democracy, but you also have to figure out when listening to others, whether or not what they're saying requires you to adjust your own views. So discussion kind of by definition is laying one perspective and one idea alongside other perspectives and other ideas, including your own. And from that mix, deciding what you're going to believe about a text that you're reading in class or about an issue that you're studying in class. So the emphasis that I'm putting on voice is really thinking with others, but also thinking for yourself. And that takes some unpacking, but fortunately there are models of classroom discussion that I did not invent, but do promote and do advocate and do refine and do explain in the book. The leading models, the leading models there are one called Structured Academic Controversy and another called Socratic Seminar. Both are rigorous and both produce knowledge. So a great advantage to these discussion models is that they help achieve both the objectives of deepening students' knowledge and developing their voice.
Could you summarize for the audience what each of those models entails?
Yeah, I'd love to. I love thinking about the two models and working on them. I've used them for 40 years in my teaching, but I've been working on them all that time too. And several of the chapters in the book philosophize those two models as well. So the book is kind of a social foundations of classroom discussion. And by social foundations of, I mean the political philosophy of, the history of, the sociology of classroom discussion. So these two models are structured. They're participation structures. Socratic seminar, let me start with it, is of course text-based. You're having a seminar about a text that the teacher has selected because she finds it mind-altering in some way. So it's probably an excerpted text from something larger and it's renowned and rich and mind-altering because of the concepts in the text are difficult and generative. Concepts like the separation of powers or individual rights or how should we treat our enemies and why are there enemies and standard social studies content. So SAC is a structure that occurs entirely in small groups. This is one reason why novice teachers, student teachers, find their first attempts at structured academic controversy to be more or less successful. It's a very doable model, largely because of the structure. They're not trying to lead a whole class discussion, which is, as anybody who knows and has tried, is one of the great difficult things in teaching. It's a noble quest, but when one pursues it, one is being quixotic, you might say. It's tough. Probably one text that many, many secondary social studies teachers have tried to lead a seminar on is Martin Luther King's Letter from Birmingham Jail. It counts as one of those great mind-altering texts with really juicy ideas in it. And the concept love is there, the concept law is there, the concept justice is there, the concept outside agitator is there. That's what he's accused of being while he's in the Birmingham City Jail. So SAC has texts as well. Seminars and SACs both have texts. This is how the knowledge is produced alongside hearing what your classmates are saying about the text. So in SAC, it all occurs in small groups of about four. You're immediately divided into two opposing pairs. Each pair takes a different position on the question that the teacher is posing about the text. Eventually, students can themselves pose questions about the text, but they need to learn how to do that from good examples that have been provided in prior SACs by the teacher.
Could you give an example of what a question might be in a structured academic controversy?
Mm-hmm. Let's leave King's Letter from Birmingham Jail for a minute and go to one that has been popularized by the Stanford History Education Group. My good friend Sam Weinberg there, was Lincoln a racist? Mm-hmm. So, of course, there has to be material about Lincoln and his racial views that students are reading. There has to be a text. That question is an empirical question, we might notice. It's true. It gets at true or false. Was he a racist or not? It's working with the concept racism and applying it to this individual, Lincoln. You know, another SAC, an ethical one, should the U.S. have used atomic weapons to end World War II? So that's, of course, requires lots of reading and knowledge before you can enter that question capably. One pair in the small group will be taking the yes position. The other pair will be taking the no position. Same with the Lincoln question. Was he a racist? Yes, no. So you notice already that the structure simplifies a difficult, rich controversy by reducing it to two sides. Now, do controversies typically have more than two sides? Of course they do. But one reason even novice teachers are typically successful with SACs is the simplification that's made. So it gives students an on-ramp into the controversy. It can always be made much more complex later, but by then students will have gotten on board into the issue, made quite a bit of progress. And at the end of a SAC, students drop these positions that they were assigned at the beginning of the SAC, taking the yes position or the no position, and are generating they're learning to think for themselves. They're generating their own view by the time they've been part of this small group discussion. Each pair has presented. Each pair has presented back to the opposing pair their argument to their satisfaction. Then they've discussed the issue, and the culmination is, now drop your role. What do you really think? What's your position on this controversy? And by then, students have heard other students discuss this, and they're in a position to decide whether or not they need to adjust their own view. And that's typically then the follow-up writing where students elaborate their own stand on the issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the SAC, they are assigned to positions and then they switch. They have the opportunity to take a different position and then they drop their roles and think about their own positions on the issue after having given voice to both sides and listened to both sides and read documents on both sides. In the seminar, students read deeply a text with a certain essential question, correct? There's a certain thing that they're supposed to be trying to glean from the text. Is that right?
That's right. And by the way, your summary of SAC was absolutely A+. So yes, at seminar now, the teacher's attempting a whole class discussion. Mm-hmm. So seminar's more difficult. Mm-hmm. And novices have much more trouble with seminars. And those of us who teach and have taught for a long time, like you and I, still suffer many, many difficulties trying to lead seminars. And it's a lifelong practice. So in a seminar, the standard protocol is that students have read and annotated a text before the seminar begins. So there's a whole raft of difficulties there already, because how do you get students to actually do homework assignments of that sort, like reading and annotating a text. It's very difficult, as any actual teacher knows, to get compliance. Same with college graduate seminars. As we know, those are often places where people who have not done the reading get together and discuss it anyway. So we have to work with the difficulty of getting the reading done. SAC handles that really nicely, which is why novices are often successful at it. Just to switch back to SAC for a minute, that in pairs, the students read and annotate the text together and prepare a presentation that they're going to make to the opposing team on their position. As the reading specialist in your school building knows, that is a definite victory right there, because the students are doing the reading because they have to perform a task that requires knowledge of the text. So you get a lot of compliance that way. Of course, students do the reading with their partner because they're having to prepare a presentation, and then they're having to make the presentation to the opposing team. Seminar doesn't have that scaffolding built in. So the teacher needs to do her best structured setup to get kids to do the reading, to do the annotation. Typically, one of the classic moves there is to just focus on an excerpt from the text that might be printed on one page of text, you know, not unlike this, but with a lot less text on it, much more white, calming white space around the margins. And it might be just that excerpt from King's letter from Birmingham jail, where he's talking about when you need to break a law because it's an unjust law, how should you go about that? What is King's advice on how to break an unjust law? Now, the teacher knows that that's a particular type of question. That's a literal question. The answer to that is in the text.
Right.
So they could go back to that section of the text and respond to that literal question. But next comes the interpretive question, which isn't directly in the text. You have to, and you can tell when you're leading a seminar, when you've asked an interpretive question, everybody's heads come up from the text. It's their eyes roll back into their brains, so to speak, because you have to figure out the interpretive question. And what's coming next is an evaluative question that gets at students' own values. So the text really isn't needed at that point, because our values exist in our own hearts and minds, so to speak. Let me switch from King's letter from Birmingham jail over to the Pledge of Allegiance, which all of your listeners will most likely know, having been required to memorize it in elementary school. So a good interpretive question for the Pledge of Allegiance is, what are we pledging our allegiance to when we recite this text? You have to kind of go back to that short text and think about it, but there'll be many different answers to that question. There's probably no text that I've used more often to train teachers in seminar methodology than the Pledge of Allegiance. And the interpretive question, what are we pledging our allegiance to, gets all manner of results. And where people get mad and they have bad memories of it, and they you come back to the question, yeah, but what are we pledging our allegiance to? Let's leave aside for a minute whether or not people should be pledging allegiance to anything, especially this. The question at the moment is, what are we pledging our allegiance to when we recite this pledge? There'll be all manner of responses to that. We spend a certain amount of time on that in a 50-minute classroom period, maybe 20 minutes on that interpretive question. Then we switch to the evaluative question. You know, in our state law requires that we recite this pledge at the beginning of the school day in elementary classrooms, or whatever the law about that is in your own state. My question to you now is, do you think it should be required, or should that law be changed? Well, mm-hmm. Now we've gone to values with the S word should, indicating that we've moved mm-hmm. to an ethical question now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But notice how it's tied to the text. So we haven't left the text, but we don't need to be looking at it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so there might be a 10-minute or so seminar now on that evaluative question, where the teacher is using her various seminar moves to broaden the participation, to hear from people we haven't heard from yet, giving students an opportunity then, maybe as a culmination, to jot down their own position about the interpretive question or the evaluative question. And mm-hmm. then that wraps up a seminar, after which the teacher makes sure to have reserved about 5 minutes for a debrief, where she asks, how do you think we all did in this seminar today? What do we need to work on to do better in our next seminar? So it's a meta reflective moment about mm-hmm. seminar itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Those strategies seem so powerful, and I can see how they would teach a number of really important skills for good informed civic engagement, including text analysis, listening, verbal communication, and if there is a written component, written communication. So those are all vital skills. One thing mm-hmm. that I wonder about as I listen to you discuss these really powerful strategies that I hope a lot of listeners and educators out there employ is the crises that you start with in the beginning of the book, which are so important right now, the legitimacy crisis and the epistemic crisis. I'm wondering how you think these really powerful models of discussion, or other models perhaps, could help to address these two major crises. Are there certain types of texts or certain types of questions that you think could be used in a SAC or in a seminar to help students respect the legitimacy of the government, or have a better ability to sort truth from fiction mm-hmm. and everything in between?
Yeah, great question, Brett. And the answer to that question is really the chapters in the book. So I deal very directly with that question, how tying these discussion models back to the legitimacy and the epistemic. Both knowledge and voice are needed. They work in tandem. And discussion is a pedagogical model, and SAC and seminar are specific models for dealing both with the knowledge problem and the voice problem. For starts, let's notice that in both a SAC and a seminar, students are talking with one another, and the models are structured to bring out student-to-student dialogue. Mm-hmm. Now, these fellow students are not necessarily friends. That's why school is a great place to teach students to talk with strangers who have different ideologies and different points of view and different life experiences and different standpoints, different power relations among the students. That's all going on in a classroom, which makes a school and a classroom really kind of the ideal space for educating both knowledge and voice. I have a mm-hmm. chapter in the book called Listening to Strangers. Mm-hmm. And the point that it makes early on in the chapter is that we go to school with friends and family. You might have an older sibling or a younger sibling in the same school building. There might be kin there. There might be friends there. There's mainly a lot of acquaintances there. These are people that we are not necessarily friends with, but we know them. And then there are friends there too. Well, in a seminar or a SAC, there's a very good possibility that you're working with acquaintances and strangers. And this is very important democratic training for all of us to learn to discuss controversial issues with others who have different points of view. And it's a way of breeding respect. You mentioned respect in your question, Because when we listen to other people's reasons, this is a very high form of respect. We immediately grant the person an interior that has values and reasoning and thoughts and opinions and views, and we're approaching them as a curious person who wants to know what those are. So SAC structures that conversation, as do seminars, very directly. Now, when you say that your own view of the matter is that Lincoln was a racist, help me understand your reasons. I believe I got your first reason, but you hinted at a second, and I'd like to know that. So we're really just trying to draw out the supports people have for the opinion that they've expressed. Now, over to the knowledge side for a moment. We're already gaining knowledge of what other people think about the issue, but it's text-based, so the teacher has decided to zero in on some particular concept or issue. It speaks directly to the knowledge crisis of an adult population that knows so little about government and politics that they cannot tell you what the three branches of government are. They mm-hmm. cannot define federalism for you. And that's one reason why they don't know what to do in terms of their action. It's the same with students. When students do a senior civic project to engage them in community problems, they have to understand how to take action. Do you write a letter to the president, or do you write a letter to your mayor? Who has mm-hmm. jurisdiction over this problem?
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the legitimacy crisis is in part related to a lack of knowledge, a lack of conceptual knowledge. And if the populace had better conceptual knowledge about federalism or about the history of federalism and the institutions that govern us, then people would have more respect for the government around them. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure you can get to respect. I hope so. But you can get to knowledge.
So how do you get to legitimacy? That's my question. How do you get to a place where people accept that the government is legitimate and that there is a social contract that we all accept and we don't need to storm the Capitol?
Yeah. Well, my friend, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because legitimacy is about trust.
Mm-hmm.
And trust is the key to both government and the economy. Putting that together, we might call it political economy. Because when you loan money to somebody, it's all a matter of trust that it'll come back to you. So business relies on trust, but so does liberal democracy rely on trust, that we trust mostly that the government operates in our best interests. We trust mostly that the system, liberal democracy, for all of its maddening flaws, is aimed at justice and can best achieve justice when you compare it to the alternatives. Mm-hmm. Liberal democracy is never a matter of what is best and what is worst. It's a matter of what is bad and worse quite often.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to withdraw and hold some of our expectations and hopes in reserve, and trust that liberal democracy managed to undo Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard now with the dysfunctionality of Congress to trust, but we must restore trust and we must restore respect for our fellow citizens because they're who we have to work with.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the potential outcomes, I think, of these seminars, actually, which it's that trust, right? Would you say that that's something that we haven't, I don't know if we've touched on that as one of the potential outcomes of seminar. We've talked about voice, skills of textual analysis, listening, and perhaps writing skills. But there's also that sense of I'm living right here in my school in a small-scale, diverse community. And this perhaps could lead to trust of those who are not my friends or family, but my acquaintances. And this might help me think that I can see inside somebody's mind a little bit more and see that people that I don't know very well could be people with legitimate perspectives that I can hear and respect, and they hear me and respect me. So I wonder if that also could be one of the outcomes of these discussions that could perhaps address the legitimacy crisis that you're concerned about.
Yeah. Well, that itself is a great interpretive question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the text is the SAC model and the seminar model, and the interpretive question there is how might those actually build trust through the ways that you just suggested, by learning that the other people sitting around the room are not cardboard characters.
Mm-hmm.
They have interiors, they have hearts and minds, they have reasons for what they do. Can I learn what those reasons are? And as a consequence of that listening, perhaps adjust my own opinions.
Mm-hmm.
I love that moment in any SAC or seminar where students find themselves trying to decide whether or not what they thought was their opinion needs to be adjusted as a consequence of what they've heard.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, Brett, that we have to understand the gravity of the situation, the epistemic problem that we have, where we are now lacking a set of shared criteria for determining fact and fiction.
Right.
For crying out loud, we suffered a president who lied brazenly and relentlessly, and whose purpose in lying, I do quote his interview with Leslie Stahl early on in the book. She's asking him, what is his motivation for attacking the press the way he does, accusing them of lying constantly, the whole fake news concept that he introduced into our civil discourse. And he replied, you know why I do it, Leslie? I do it to discredit you all and demean you all, so that when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, he was really successful there. And his chief advisor, Steve Bannon, reiterated that strategy in an interview with the great Michael Lewis. And Bannon said, yeah, our real opposition is not the Democrats. Our real opposition is the media. And the way to deal with the media is to flood the zone with shit. Mm-hmm. So in other words, flood it with lies and fiction. And, you know, right out of the barn, Trump was lying about the size of the crowd gathered at his inauguration. And so we have to work very hard to reestablish shared criteria for what counts as truth. And that's why another hugely important aspect of any social studies teaching today is dealing with online literacy and how to determine the truth and credibility of online sources. And fortunately, mm-hmm. there's a lot of people in our field that are working on that, including yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like that in itself could be a topic of a seminar or a SAC. How do we determine the truth of a particular source, or which of these sources is more legitimate? I don't know how you would address that. What are your suggestions for how to address the epistemic crisis? There's the Stanford History Education Group that has the Civic Online Reasoning curricula and other materials. And there is also there are a number of organizations working on this, including Namely, News Literacy Project, and a few others. What are your thoughts on how that can be addressed, the epistemic crisis? Can discussions, as we discussed earlier, be part of the solution?
Yes, indeed. I think what you just suggested, a seminar on texts that deal with the epistemic crisis, is certainly worth doing. For a seminar or a SAC on that, we'd have to find texts that deal directly with the online literacy crisis that we're facing, and that would become the subject matter then of that SAC or seminar. But also, in both seminar and SAC, typically the texts that we're reading is an account of something, and then we compare that account with alternative accounts, so mm-hmm. that we are teaching students how to corroborate across multiple accounts. And that's basic history instruction. The goal of history instruction is to teach students to make supportable claims about the past. And to make a supportable claim, you have to deal with multiple accounts, both primary and secondary sources, of course.
Well, Walter, this has been a really enlightening interview. It's been so great to talk to you. I do have another question that I'd like to ask you about and then give you the chance to say anything, you know, you'd like the audience to hear. My last question is about opportunities beyond the social studies classroom for building democratic competence and democratic engagement. You mentioned that you see social studies as being the center of the civic learning experience. What about the school beyond the social studies classroom?
Yeah, great question. Yes, I do argue in the book that social studies is the logical home for civic education in the school because of its subject matter, particularly government, politics, and history. And then for history, that would be state history, regional history, world history, and of course, national history. And any school system's scope and sequence for history and civic learning needs to be pulled off the shelf and updated and thought about by a group of people, including parents, very carefully. Of course, civic learning goes beyond the social studies curriculum, deeply into the literature curriculum, and of course, the science curriculum. Social studies, like the sciences, deals with making warrantable claims, supportable claims. That what we call science in the schools is the natural sciences, but the social sciences are right there as well. But you referenced importantly something that I stress in chapter three of the book, which is that the school is a micro society and it has all the assets needed for civic learning. It has a diverse student body, and that diversity is an asset that can be mobilized for the sake of civic learning. The school has a curriculum, the school has teachers, everything that's needed is right there. So it needs to be mobilized. And one way to do it throughout the school is treating the school as a community. I think maybe never was there a better community approach to democratic education than in Massachusetts at the Brookline schools, back when they had an approach they called the just community approach. But basically, boiled down, it's a really good student council system. They need to be in elementary schools, in middle schools, and in high schools, and they deal with the controversial policy issues that come with schooling. And, you know, there needs to be one of the school principals, the dean of students, something like that, who is really mobilized to organize a good student council system in schools. I'm all for them. And then within the school district, there are councils that are inter-school councils. That whole infrastructure for dealing with the actual on-the-ground school problems, everything from school closures to school dress codes, school attendance policy, the whole nine yards. Let students deliberate those issues and make recommendations.
Yeah, that's great. What do you think about the role of parents and teachers in that governance?
Yes, so still I think the best book written about that is Amy Gutman's book, Democratic Education, I think is the name of the book. She deals very carefully with the roles of educators, parents, and government leaders in education. We're at a very tense time now with regard to parents and their role in education, but of course they have a role. They have a very important role, not only through parent-teacher councils, but in terms of parent participation in school boards. So first, I'd recommend that all of us democratic educators bone up on that question that you ask. And my recommended way to bone up on it is read Amy Gutman's book, just chapter one, gets right into the nitty-gritty quickly. And I'm going to pull it off the shelf after this interview and practice what I preach.
Great. Thank you so much, Walter. Is there anything else? We've covered a lot of ground. It's been really fantastic. I'm so glad that we had the chance to talk. Anything else you'd like the audience of teachers, parents, teacher educators, student teachers to hear?
Yes. An important point, I think, is that because I did mention the high school government course and how important I believe that is in K-12 education, let me say that the most important obstacle to teachers being successful in that course is the absence of a robust social studies curriculum in elementary schools. Social studies has to be restored to elementary schools, particularly grades 2, 3, 4, 5, six, if that's in the elementary school, but usually it's in a middle school these days. The post-war elementary school social studies curriculum in the United States was robust. Third grade, communities near and far, now and then. Near and far is education jargon for geography. My community contrasted with sister communities in other nations. Now and then, the history, what was going on in my area, this land, long before it was settled. What's going on in this community now today? There in the community are the three branches of government. I can assure you, you've got some sort of executive, some sort of legislature, and some sort of judicial. Fourth grade typically was state history. Fortunately, I see that coming back in the United States. I've worked on a fourth grade Florida history book. I've worked on a California history book. I'm working now on a fourth grade Rhode Island state history. So I can tell that state histories are coming back. In the state of Washington, it's the League of Women Voters who wrote the fourth grade state history book. Fifth grade U.S. history. So this needs to be robust. There needs to be time for it. All the research is suggesting that one of the reasons that we have an adolescent literacy crisis right now is that adolescents' vocabulary was not enriched by an elementary school social studies curriculum where all of those concepts from peninsula to wetlands to mesa and mayor and firefighters and police and the police guild, all of that vocabulary that comes with a robust elementary social studies curriculum will make the American public smarter as adults. There's nothing more powerful that we could do now, I think, than restoring a rich, serious, knowledge-based social studies curriculum in grades 2 through 5.
Thank you. I agree wholeheartedly. Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, Walter. And yeah, thanks for your book. So everyone out there, please go out and buy it and share it with your students, share it with your friends. It's a great read and has a lot of wisdom.
Brett, wonderful talking with you. Thanks so much for this wonderful podcast and all the energy and time and labor that goes into producing it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. That was Walter Parker, Professor Emeritus at the University of Washington, Seattle. Please visit the show notes to learn more about Walter, his book, and other issues and resources that we discussed. And this is Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy. To support the show, please subscribe to the podcast feed and YouTube channel and like the show on Facebook. Links to those pages are in the show notes. When you give the show 5 stars in your podcast app, it helps the show's rating and allows other people to find the show. So please tap that 5-star rating in your podcast app. Thank you so much for listening and for all your support, and please stay engaged.
Thank you for listening.